You're listening to 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Scholars consider the letters of the Apostle Paul critical for understanding the historical foundations of Christianity. But those messages to and from Paul's various contacts in the first century Roman world also contain the atmosphere of their day. Just like our tweets and text messages today, the letters Paul wrote and read describe the world of his times. Politics, economics, even social justice. Dr. Laura Nasrallah studies these writings. Ahead of her talk at the UT Department of Religious Studies annual Dungen Lecture, Nasrallah made time to speak with me about how our modern conversations about topics such as race aren't as modern as you might think.
Ideas of race and ethnicity in antiquity were different from the ways in which we define them today. And there's been a lot of great work on this in the classics and in the study of early Christianity. So the work I'm doing is also building on a trajectory of scholarship. The way in which race was defined in antiquity was complicated. I'm going to give you an example from a second century writer. His name is Claudius Ptolemy, and he was an astronomer and a geographer. And in general, people who study ancient history are really embarrassed about the fact that amid these amazing scientific texts he wrote, he also wrote a text called the Tetra Vivlos. And the Tetra Vivlos is this text of astrology. And what it says, basically, is that if you divide up the different regions of the world, you can look at the heavens under which those regions are disposed. You can look at the gods who control those heavens. And then you can look at the personality traits, how people look in those different climata or regions of the world. And he does some really disturbing stuff. So let me give you what you'd expect, which is that Claudius Ptolemy says, well, the people in Rome and the people in Greece, well, they're the best, right? They have the best gods, the most rational, things are working very well for them. But the ways in which he treats other people, whether in Ethiopia or in Gaul, are much more disparaging. So while we might not have the precise vocabulary that maps onto our understandings of race in the present, we can see the ways in which ethnic reasoning is going on in the ancient world. And in using that term ethnic reasoning, I'm drawing on a colleague's work, Denise Buell, and she looks at the ways in which early Christians, as they talk about themselves in this world, sometimes describe themselves as a new race or a new genos or a new laos, a new people. So again, different vocabulary, but some concepts that are quite analogous to the ways in which we think about race today and in the ways in which racism and prejudice also operate in the contemporary world.
Are the conversations that Paul has then about the subject of race recognizable to us today? This seems a little bit familiar, what you're describing, looking at people differently because they look different or they live in a different part of the world and they have different customs, and we start to build expectations about them based on that. So it sounds like these conversations are substantially similar to the ones we're still having today.
Right. Well, they're similar to the ones that we're still having today. And actually, some of our conversations today draw on the letters of Paul to make arguments about race, racism, and universalism. Let me take one example, which is maybe the most famous in conversation about the letters of Paul. It comes from Galatians 3:28. And the text says, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female. It's probably part of a baptismal formula that actually predates Paul. But it seems to suggest with this, there's neither Jew nor Greek, a kind of erasure of ethnic identity, of racial identity in the ancient world. And it's definitely been used that way. People have used it to argue that Christianity today should be colorblind, that it should be the philosophical basis for a universalistic way of thinking. But often when people argue that, and I tried to hint at that with using the word colorblind, they're precisely not coping with contemporary racism. They're sort of saying, well, the letters of Paul say it should all go away, so let's all just get along, without then also calculating, well, what are the centuries of injustice? What are the centuries of racism? How do we really fix this problem? The other thing that to me is really interesting about that verse, which is quoted so often, not only in Christian circles today, but also by contemporary political theologians who say that they're atheists. No dog in the fight, but they think Paul is this amazing exemplar for thinking through the possibility of universalism in the present. What they don't notice is that immediately after that, Paul says, and you will all be Abraham's seed. So he's not actually saying let's be colorblind, let's be universalistic. What he's saying is that for those who are not Jewish among the people to whom he's speaking, they have the possibility of coming into a Jewish lineage. So it's actually a very interesting argument, but it's deployed now in ways that aren't really accurate to the details of the text from the ancient world.
Let me ask you, what surprises you? Obviously, you have a lot more experience than I do or our audience does in looking at these documents that we still have. What surprises you as you read about the conversations Paul has in both directions, what he's saying and what people are saying back to him about the subject of race during this period?
I think what always surprises and excites me about these texts that we call early Christian, but which actually date to a period before the term Christianity even existed, is how full they are of struggle. And I think that really depresses some people. They think, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if early Christian origins were kind of perfect and utopian? But for me, I find it even more exciting that they precisely mirror the kinds of debates and arguments and productive thinking that we have in communities today. So most people like to focus on what Paul says and try to use him as a kind of exemplar. Like, is he the best way to think through universalism, justice, transformation? Can we take him and kind of plug and play him into a contemporary culture? But what I like to do in my work is to think about the broader social, economic, and political context of the people to whom Paul first wrote, because he calls them brothers and sisters. And it's pretty clear from his letters to them that they did not always agree with him, that they sometimes thought he was really wrong. So in these letters, in which Paul is proposing certain ideas about ethnicity, in which Paul is proposing certain ideas about gender, about justice, about how to live in the Roman Empire, what we can trace are ways in which other people wrote back or talked back and had different ideas about how to construct a just, transformative life in the Roman Empire, but also at a time that they thought was probably the end of the world.
I want to stick on that subject for just a little bit, because I know a lot of your work is based on going beyond the theological implications or the theological statements that are made in Paul's letters, but to those broader issues that we're talking about. What was going on politically at the time, culturally, socially, economically? Tell me how you begin to construct a picture of the ancient world and its people, which we might think of as being very primitive and very bad. I mean, they didn't even have smartphones. I mean, you've got to be kidding me. They didn't even have Netflix, right? But tell me a little bit about what you learn about the complexity of what those people did that might surprise our audiences today.
Yeah, absolutely. So no Netflix, but amazing, amazing transformative sea routes and roads and ways of communicating with each other. So technically speaking, the way I go about it, the way we go about it as scholars of New Testament and early Christianity, involves looking at texts that were written at the same time that Paul was writing. We look at evidence from inscriptions. We look at other kinds of archaeological evidence, even sometimes to people's bones. What can we tell from their bones or their teeth about diseases, about the age of weaning, about immigration, about health in general in antiquity? We look at all these different elements to try to reconstruct the lives of those to whom, say, Paul wrote, or the lives of those, say, who lived in first century Palestine at the time of the life of Jesus. And what we see are different things depending on where we are, right? I mean, I just flew in from Boston. Things that are going on there are different from what's going on in Knoxville. Of course, there are common conversations. We're within the same country. There are modes of communication. And there were, too, in the Roman Empire. But there are local problems, too. So I'm particularly interested, say, let me give you an example, the town of Philippi. So Paul writes a letter to the Philippians. And if we look at the town of Philippi, which is located in northern Greece today, that was a veteran colony. What does it mean to have been a soldier who is then granted land and who settles that land? What does that mean to the people who were already on the land in the first place? What kind of cultic associations, what kind of groups do they form with each other? And why is it that some of those groups are actually Roman, right? For example, the worship of the god Silvanus, who's a Roman god. So that's the kind of detailed, fine-grained stuff that I like to look at in order not just to think about this one man whom many think of as a kind of hero or as a founder of Western civilization, but to think about the many to whom he wrote.
I think it'd be facile to ask you a question that's like, so what does Paul tell us that we can still use today? Obviously, he was a man of his time. We are people of our times. But what do you glean? What can be used? What do you feel is most useful for informing our conversations about race, socioeconomics, politics today that isn't so dated but can still be really useful or profound or worth consideration today?
Right. It's a great question. And the phrase that I often think of in my work is disciplined intimacy when we look at ancient texts. So the discipline part of it comes from always recognizing that they are far away from us, that they come from a different time period, from a different geographical location, that we shouldn't think that we understand what's going on in them. We need to be disciplined and thoughtful. And the intimacy part comes from that moment, you know, just like when you flip to Us magazine and you look at the celebrities and it says, oh, they're just like us. They go shopping. They do yoga. So too, we know in antiquity, they're just like us. They struggled with common issues of, say, a child who's sick and the desperate desire to help that child to survive a fever. They struggled with problems of, how do I deal with someone who's speaking to me in a different language? How do I sail the seas safely? How do I make enough money? So I think the question of what these texts can tell us is really relevant. There's a historian, Carolyn Dinshaw, who uses the phrase touching across time. And so when we look at the letters of Paul, some of the things that we can learn from them are ways in which ancient communities struggled over women's leadership and authority. And we definitely see that today as well. We can learn that even though you had suggested that these are kind of primitive people, they don't have Twitter, they live way back when, right? It's about the patriarchy back then. We also know that there were female prophets, that there were women who were extremely influential in government. So there we find examples that might be transformative for today to think, oh, you know, female leadership in government is not a new thing. It's not a sort of, you know, 20-year-old or 100-year-old history. When we look at issues of race and ethnicity, we can see ways in which it seems like there's evidence from Jewish and Christian communities in antiquity that they may have been trying to pool their economic resources together in order to manumit or free those who were enslaved. So they had really creative ways to hijack, to move around, to create a utopian society in the midst of a larger society that was a complete slave state. So from there, we can glean imaginaries, we can glean new strategies for living in the present. The tricky thing about the letters of the Paul, of course, is that they're not, no one's reading the letters of Cicero and saying, oh, these are scripture. How are we going to base our lives on them today? For the letters of Paul, we've got a double task because we can look at them as historical documents, but we also know that today, those letters, other texts from the New Testament or the Christian Testament, are mobilized for completely opposite purposes in the current political and social climate. And what becomes hard is how do we adjudicate which reading of these letters is accurate, which reading is right, and how do we say, well, I'm going to take responsibility for my interpretation.
I want to close out the interview by asking about interpretation, because this was on my mind as you were speaking, how views of and contextualizing Paul's letters and writings have changed themselves over time. So if you were sitting at a table with Thomas Jefferson and Aquinas, would you all agree on the interpretation of these words, or would each person from those various generations, those centuries that we're talking about, feel very differently about Paul's writings based on what they were going through and what they were thinking, what was popular at their time?
There are definitely differences in interpretation of these writings over centuries and between people. And let me give you an example. There's a passage in the letter to the Romans, Romans 13, that a lot of people would rather argue Paul didn't write at all. And it starts out by saying you should be subject to the governing authorities. A lot of people want to say, well, Paul was a kind of post-colonial revolutionary. He really resisted the Roman Empire. And it's embarrassing to find this be subject to the governing authorities in the middle of it. And let me give you examples of how that text has been used in a few different contexts. First of all, at the time of the American Revolution, this text was used to argue the exact opposite points. One preacher used it to argue, be subject to the governing authorities, stop rebelling against the king, it's over, right? The American revolutionaries are wrong. Another preacher used it to say, be subject to the governing authorities, but only if they're ordained by God. So you have to revolt. It's actually your moral duty to resist. When the fugitive slave law came out in 1850 or so, people used Romans 13 to argue that slaves had to be returned to their masters, even as others used other parts of the letters of Paul to say there should be no slavery, right? There's no longer slave or free. We have to move past this. Recently, Jeff Sessions used Romans 13 in a speech to law enforcement to argue, be subject to the governing authorities. We need to prevent migrants from coming into this country. These texts can be used in so many different ways. We need to take responsibility for how we use these texts in contemporary arguments. Instead of pretending that they speak for themselves, we need to do two things. First of all, to say, well, what might they have meant in the ancient world? What's the range of possible interpretations in the ancient world? But then we also have to take moral responsibility for how we want to use them today.
Laura Nasrallah is a professor at the Harvard Divinity School. She'll be delivering the Department of Religious Studies annual Dungan Lecture, Race in the Letters of Paul, today. Dr. Nasrallah, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I'm so grateful, Brandon.